Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
どこにいるのかな。見えない。
あ、
ここ
にいる。In your personal top 10 games of all times list, what is the outlier? And what's the one game that you wouldn't expect to find on anybody else's list? That is the question posed by Waypoint forum goer Sky Ridge, and it is our topic today on Waypoint Radio, episode 155. I'm Danielle Riendo. Joining me today here in Lobby 1 on this sunny New York day is, of course, Austin Walker.
That's me. I didn't hear the second part of that question before, so I'm excited that there's kind of like double whammy in there. Yeah,
a little extra in there. I actually didn't realize it was in there until I just looked again for the cold open. I was like, yeah, that's good. I'm going to throw that in there.
Yeah.
And, of course, joining me as well. I don't know if it's sunny up there in Boston, but Rob Zachney.
It is very sunny.
Oh, good. Makes me very happy.
It's different from the weird fog that like closed over Boston a few days ago.
Yeah.
It was very like end of the world stuff.
It was the Yogg. That's what happened. I think the Yogg came to Boston, but now you're rebuilding and you're living your life. We streamed the Yogg this morning, so I've got a lot of Yogg on the brain. Now, the Yogg is not in my personal top 10. I think it's great.
It's on the edge of mine.
Yeah?
It's reflected in mine via some other games, is what I would say.
That's totally cool. I think the way to do this, since I just thought this was such a fun, awesome topic, it would garner some good discussion, and it was a forum topic this week.
Yeah, who did the forum topic again?
This is Sky Ridge.
Shout out to Sky Ridge.
Thank you, Sky Ridge. That's a great topic, great thread. Really excited about the discussion going on in there. I figured we could all share our top tens, and we could kind of discuss what's an outlier and what's a game we don't expect to be on, if not anybody else's list, like many people's list. You know, the one that's kind of like, oh, that's interesting, that sort of thing. Austin, do you want to go first?
Sure.
No, you don't want to go first.
So I have two thoughts.
Okay.
I'm me, which means that my list is 12 things long instead of 10.
I mean, yeah, I have...
No.
It's
not okay.
It's unordered. Yeah, okay, listen, just wait until you get to Danielle's then.
Yeah.
Danielle has entries that are two different games on the same.
One of them is up to five. Yeah.
What?
Wait, like one spot holds like five different
one
games?
One of them might be a series because I have a different favorite in it every day. So.
Okay, it's fine for this to be provisional. I just want this to be like today's thing
is
blah.
Provisional. This is all provisional,
But the more important thing is I'm having a hard time seeing what an outlier is, except... I think I have it worked out, but it's like a weird meta outlier.
Okay. That's all right. You're in a safe space, Austin.
I know, but I'm saying maybe we shouldn't start with me.
Okay.
We should start with one that's like, oh, here are 10 games. Like, it sounds like Rob might have picked 10 games, unlike you and I, Danielle. And hear what they are and then talk about the outlier. That way we can set like a standard.
Yeah, there we go. Rob, do you want to set the standard for Waypoint right now?
Okay, well...
is yours also though, compromised? Because... Is it?
No. No, it is 10 games.
Okay.
But the thing I'll say is, like, look, I am a child of 90s PC gaming.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's just who I am.
You don't have to apologize.
Yeah,
all of
yourself.
Our lists are going to look like no top 10 list ever anywhere.
That's correct.
Welcome to Waypoint, motherfuckers.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so 10 is Silent Hunter 3.
Okay.
Sure, that's a submarine game.
Pardon?
It's a submarine game?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's a U-boat sim.
Okay.
9 is Fear, a.k.a. First Encounter Assault Recon.
Good.
Not Fear 3. 3 isn't in there, right?
No.
Okay.
No, not for Threer. So I have a soft spot for Fear 3, but I also have some beef with
Fear 3 has a mech, so you know.
I see. Yeah. I see.
Those sections aren't that good. Anyway, continue.
8, Close Combat 2, Bridge Too Far. 7, the very first Medieval Total War.
Okay.
6, Free Space 2.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right.
5 is Alpha Centauri. 4 is Last Express.
Yeah.
3 is Dishonored.
Awesome.
2 is TIE Fighter.
I just added another game. As you were going down this list, I was like, I have to add TIE Fighter to this
we
list.
We got to 13.
Fuck.
And 1 is Stalker Shadow Chernobyl.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It seems like a very Rob
list. That's a very Rob list. I'm curious what the outlier in that list is for you.
Hmm. I mean, the two, there's actually, it depends on how you want to look at things, right? There's
it
only
does.
One adventure game on that list.
Yeah, Last Express the Last is the Express. One that popped up for me.
I was thinking Dishonored, actually.
Mm.
But more for the stealth stuff than the immersive sim stuff.
Right.
But
with
like,
Stalker
can,
and Dishonored, you have an immersive sim, like, tradition. Like, they might end up in radically different places, but, like, if someone's in a Stalker, like, it doesn't surprise me that they're in a Dishonored or vice versa,
that's
right?
True.
And Deus Ex nearly made this list. Ooh. And, like, that also would have been of a piece with those.
Okay.
You know, TIE Fighter and Free Space 2 are two space combat sims.
Right.
So they kind of are of a piece. Medieval Total War, Close Combat, you know, historical wargaming, strategy gaming. Not huge surprises there. So the ones that end up being kind of oddballs, I think, Fear is the most, like, basic, like, shooter-ass shooter on that list.
Yeah.
But there are still first-person shooters on the list, which means that Silent Hunter 3, I think, you know, at the 10 position, is kind of the weirdo of the group, because it's a submarine sim. Like, most of your time spent in this game is learning how to input, like, torpedo firing solutions.
Yeah, I'm with you, but, like, isn't that just an extension of what makes TIE Fighter so cool? As, like, it's a double down on systems management and, like, thinking about, like, vehicles as more than just a wheel and a gas pedal and a gun. Do you know what I mean?
True, though I think maybe it's even closer peer than is almost Dishonored. So TIE Fighter is very action-oriented. It is very systems management as well, like, the name of the game in all the LucasArts space combat sims is, like, managing your power settings and what's your firepower versus your speed and defensive power, your shields.
Those games are good.
They're very, very good. Silent Hunter 3 is, like, yes, you're a warship, but really you're an assassin.
Right.
Like, you can't fight anybody in this game. If it's a fight you're in, that probably means you are just utterly doomed and are going to be killed pretty quickly. And so a lot of Silent Hunter 3 is all about sort of studying your target, anticipating their movements, working your way closer and closer and closer to the point where you can launch the attack and then get out of there before you're ever detected. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you'll leave burning ships behind you. People will know you were there, but you will not be.
Right. That's interesting. I can see that. I can see that connection.
Yeah, there's something there. There's definitely. I also, God, I want to talk a little bit more about your adventure game.
Yeah, that's also where my head is.
Sort of area here,
because that's definitely the one that feels the most off for me. But like, it has the touches of the rest of your list.
Yeah.
But doesn't have the same, like, verbs.
Yes.
You know.
What are you thinking about it?
Practically none of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's connected to the others via history. Like, if a war game decided to become an adventure game, it would become The Last Express, I think, is how I would put that.
Right.
The Last Express is the Panzer General of adventure games. But it is kind of the odd one because it is probably the most purely narrative of the games and remains, you know, I mean, I did my guide to games on this, you know, I've written about this game in a few places, but it is a story and a setting that has really stuck with me over the years. And I think the other part of it is there are a few games here that, like, really resonated with me as a kid, but, like, The Last Express was something that kind of changed my relationship to history because, when you're a kid, and there's a really good Three Moves Ahead that we did with Chris Rima.
One of my favorite podcasts, period.
It's fantastic.
People should go listen to the Three Moves Ahead on Last Express.
But in that on that show, I think I said something similar to what I'm about to say now, which is, you know, if you're a kid, particularly like an American kid growing up in the 90s, it's really tempting to believe in history as this narrative of progress and good guys winning in the end. And so the '90s are very like greatest generation nostalgia, all this shit. And along comes The Last Express, and I play that. And The Last Express is to an extent explicitly about the explicitly connected to the Balkan Wars of the '90s, but it's also its own self-contained story. And playing this game, like, really puts in sharp relief, like, oh, for people in the world, for a lot of people in the world around the outbreak of World War One, this was not a story that ever came out right the other side. You know, if you were, you know, Austrian Jewish, like, history did not go the right way. The good guys did not win in the end, or except perhaps until so far out in the future, it didn't do you and your family any good.
Yeah.
If you were somebody who was just sort of swept up into that and was just hoping for life to go back to peace, stability, prosperity, for the next 30 or 40 years in Europe, like, the name of the game is going to be catastrophic war.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of revolutionary to me when I was playing it, is like, oh shit, the ending of this is utterly hopeless. And it's at the start of history that I know very, very well, but it's recast it as this process of, like, utter sundering
mm-hmm.
of the order. And there were, like, and say what you will, that order existed, and there weren't hundreds of thousands of people being killed on the front lines every day during that war, during that order. Now, you can argue that suffering was, like, transposed elsewhere.
Right. Other people were absolutely suffering at that point in time.
Yeah.
But we're not necessarily in a position to for their histories to be written as boldly or as you know, as in front of us. Yes, prominently. Yeah. Thank you. As those in control. Right.
Right.
Though I will say that there is, like, another similarity here, I think, between that game and Stalker, in a sense, mm-hmm. tonally and in terms of, like, you know, I kind of want the Stalker game that's set after The Last Express, which I guess is like a Sir, you being hunted is maybe that game in retrospect. But, like, you know, there is that sort of like, okay, well, what does that world look like? What does the tonally, is history progress or is history a collection of events lined up one after the other? And progress is a much more slippery thing. I think tonally the outcome of The Last Express and the outcome of Stalker, some of the outcomes of Stalker are pretty in line with each other in that respect.
That's very true. I mean, and both are explicitly about the end of empires mm-hmm. to an extent, and what empires leave in their wake. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what I was trying to, I think, grope my way towards when I was talking about order and such is that everybody in The Last Express, all the empires that are presented there, there's no way out for them. There's no way to take it all back and walk back from the empire, walk back from the precipice and say, like, we can redistribute this power. This doesn't have to be settled on the field of battle. We can stop being these imperialist powers armed to the teeth and at each other's throat all the time. And The Last Express, none of them are going to be able to escape from that. And they're going to basically consume each other, including a lot of the oppressed peoples and marginalized groups within those empires. They're also going to suffer. And, like, that's just part of what these empires have sort of set in motion. The minute you become a great empire, you're also sort of setting the stage for what the end of that empire is going to look like. And Stalker is also, like, pretty explicitly concerned with what the breakup of the Soviet Union left behind and the market leaves on the people who are part of it.
Yeah, I there is also, you know, the interesting thing in Stalker is that there is, and again, I've only played 12 hours of Stalker maybe in my life. It's high on my list of games I want to get to at some point. There are different sorts of people in the world of Stalker, and many of them are a sort of aftershock of an imperial regime or of a militant regime or of like a military complex, right? Like, you have your mercenary groups. You have your, like, hyper-militarized crews that go through the zone. You also, though, do have those people at the bottom rung, those who lived nearby the disaster, those who to today are still at the bottom rung or to today in that setting. And those characters, their history is written a little bit there, right? Which is interesting. Like the camera drops a little bit from the mapped level to the on the ground level. And so, you know, the kind of memes around Stalker, the like the guitar players around the campfire, the like, hey, Stalker, like all of those people, they are like the people at the bottom of the ladder who are just kind of struggling to get through day to day. And, you know, there is almost a sense of like, you're not gonna fix things. You're not gonna ever make those people go. They don't have much to go back to. What they had before was at least stable and safe. But you are even never gonna get back there. And so I do see some allegiance between or some affinity between those two games in outcome or in mood at least.
Yeah.
Well, now you got me thinking about. Sorry, just a point. The ending of The Last Express is showing a map of Europe and its borders changing,
right,
over the years as again empires rise, fall, nations are created, and then sort of shattered. But I'm also sort of thinking about like how the characters of Stalker are like explicitly people without a country,
right,
to an extent. They are prisoners inside this like. You know, this exclusion zone, basically, around Chernobyl. And, like, one of the first things you encounter in the world of Stalker is you are still subject to state violence and control.
Right.
You start out next to a checkpoint, right, where basically you're being harangued by the state day in and day out as the checkpoint guards basically tell you what, you know, pieces of shit you are and, like, don't even think about trying to escape here. And if you try to approach that checkpoint, you will be shot.
Right.
Like, it is at the edge of the map, but you can't go. Well, you can go there if you're heavily armed enough, but you're not supposed to go.
Can you get out? Can you kill them and leave? No?
No, because I think the idea is, like, it's one of those, like, double checkpoints where, like, that's the inner ring, and then there's an outer ring you can never escape. But I'm pretty sure I have overrun that checkpoint at least once.
Good. Fuck them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so that's another theme in that game is that, like, the state is still there. The state flies helicopters and assault troops into the zone all the time and fucks with you. And it sort of controls people's movements and freedom within the zone. But it doesn't care about you, and it's not going to provide any aid. It's just a sort of controlling exclusionary force.
It's funny, I just realized too, one of the games on your list that goes the other way with this, and in fact, maybe for me, to its detriment, is Dishonored, which imagines the fall of the old order and then puts you in the position. First of all, you are someone who fought to keep the old order.
Yeah.
And then the order falls apart and then you reestablish it. The end game, the end goal for you there is to put the genie back in the bottle and reestablish a more noble old order as it was. You know, you can't put the Empress back on the throne, but you can do the next best thing.
That's true.
Which is not like, you know, we've had good. I think Yousef Cole has written for us about that series and that part of that series. But I think that's an interesting contrast to The Last Express specifically, right? Because it's very much drawing on a similar period of history to craft its sort of industrial fantasy world. So
that's true.
Dishonored 2 is like. Dishonored 2 is definitely playing around with the idea that, like, Emily Caldwell has not turned out all that great as a ruler. Like, she's been okay, but a lot of stuff has been allowed to flourish, you know, at the fringes of her empire in places she just hasn't really paid attention. It's sort of explicitly... It's made very clear that the people who deposed you, the sort of, like, oppressive nobles and aristocrats who were behind all this, they've been there the entire time. If your character cared, you could have seen it happening. You just didn't, because, you know, you didn't... As long as you didn't hear the screaming coming from other parts of the empire, then who really gave a damn? And so I think Dishonored is interesting because you are repeatedly put in this position of being sort of a restorationist. Of putting the old order back together. But at the end of Dishonored, the outsider is even kind of sardonic about, like, what they're going to say about Emily Caldwell is she did the best she could in a flawed world.
Right.
That is the good ending of that game,
right,
is the way this role is going to be remembered is they did the best they could. which is pretty uninspiring. It reminds me a lot of one of the first things that a character tells you in Mafia 3. At the end of the day, his best didn't amount to a whole lot, did it?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. God, Mafia 3 has some fucking endings in that game. Anyway.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah.
Sure has some damn endings. I guess the last question, though, Rob, would be, of course, and this one might be a little easy, if there's a game you wouldn't expect to find on anybody else's list on there. It's your submarine game.
Well, we crossed TIE Fighter off the list. no, I think...
Silent Hunter, probably. Maybe.
I don't think anybody's going to be getting on that Silent Hunter bandwagon with me.
No, probably not.
Probably not Close Combat 2 either.
Mm. I think a lot of those games are toughies to find. I don't know. Not toughies, but...
You know. That was right. A very Rob Zachney list, which is perfect.
So that's 10 games.
Yes. Right.
10 games that were chosen carefully with some pain.
Can I not have numbers on mine?
You don't have to have numbers.
I have 10. I've cut it down to 10.
Okay.
Can I do my 10?
Yes, you can.
Do it.
It's not in any order. King of Dragon Pass.
Okay.
Invisible Inc. Mm-hmm. Dragon's Dogma. Mm-hmm. Far Cry 2.
Okay.
Knights of the Old Republic 2.
Good.
Streets of Rage 2. Breath of the Wild.
Two.
Morrowind. Tecmo Super Bowl. And Romance of the Three Kingdoms 10.
All right. All right.
There are... This is the thing.
You can do your honorable mentions. You are allowed.
No.
All right. Well, I'm going to do mine. So
I'm not.
All right.
Letter of the law right now. Okay. So I'm gonna force myself to live by it.
All right.
They're hard cuts. You know that one of them is TIE Fighter, which I added.
I know. I was like, oof.
There are two others that will not go mentioned.
Okay.
The thing that was really hard for me to figure out what I thought was my outlier was that it forced me to think about what was the most powerful through line between the rest and how we judge things as sets.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the obvious one of the first ones, like, oh, Tecmo Super Bowl is the only sports game, right? That's a pretty obvious way to think about this.
But that type of action does sort of permeate in other
totally.
Of those. Sorry.
And playmaking yeah. and strategizing. And, you know, especially once you start thinking about, like, part of what is attractive to me about Tecmo Super Bowl, not Tecmo Bowl, Tecmo Super Bowl, is that it's the first sports game that let you track stats across a season.
Mm.
And so, like, Romance of the Three Kingdoms 10 is that, but for Chinese history,
yep.
for this 300-year period of Chinese history, or 200-year, 130-year. Anyway, so that there is a commonality there. And, like, I obviously the action is different, but, like, the action is actually way closer to Streets of Rage 2, and that's direct action is very arcadey. It communicates a lot with very little. I think during lunch today, I actually cracked what I think is the outlier here, and it's the opposite of the second question. The second question is, what is the game that you think would not be on anybody else's list? The outlier in this list is Breath of the Wild, which is the only one I could imagine – in the top 10 of somebody else's list.
Gotcha.
Or not the only one I could imagine.
Maybe the most common one.
But the one that I could imagine on, like, an outlet's top 10 list of all time.
Sure.
And it's the one that is, I think, smoothest and cleanest and isn't janky and doesn't have some, you know, major technical problems. I guess I could imagine Morrowind there too. And there are other affinities between it and a lot of other games. There's lots of open world games on this list. Dragon's
yeah.
Dogma, Morrowind, Breath of the Wild are all even Romance of the Three Kingdoms 10, when you're playing it as, like, an individual officer, all open world games, all about exploration, all about kind of, like, learning an environment and doing side quests and all that stuff. But even Far Cry 2 fits that to some degree.
Yeah.
Even Knights of the Old Republic 2 to some degree. But it's the only one there that is like, hey, this is like a super well-made, polished product. It has its issues. Like, I you know, obviously would be remiss to not say that, like, oh, yeah, it has some transphobic elements and, like, it has some other shitty stuff that where it's dropped the ball. But it is the only game that feels like it's been put through hundreds and thousands of hours of QA. And has produced a very polished aesthetic because of that, compared to something like Dragon's Dogma, which is super rough around the edges and is kind of stock fantasy in places, or even something like Knights of the Old Republic 2, especially something like Knights of the Old Republic 2, which shipped missing its, like, a lot of its ending.
Wow.
It's just not in there. Like, a lot of the ending is there in text, in files hidden on the disc, but not in the actual game. It was never implemented.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can get all that stuff.
Modders have since made it, but I played that game originally without any of that stuff and loved it. So that stuff's great. I love all, like, play the Sith Lord's Restoration mod or whatever if you're going to play that game. But it's even without it, it's a game I really fucking love.
Just
Tell
me a little bit on Dragon's Dogma.
So my favorite thing about Dragon's Dogma is that. So it's tough now because the experience I had with Dragon's Dogma is different than the one you would have if you bought it today. If you bought it today, you'd be buying the pack with the DLC built in and a few things that made the game much easier in terms of the basic, like, game flow. Mm-hmm. You have
the name of the Dark Arisen.
The Dark Arisen, yeah, totally. I love that version too. I'm in the middle of a playthrough of it. It's like a game I go back to once every 3 or 4 weeks. I like dip in for a night to kind of like. Cleanse my palate a little bit.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing that changed is it gives you an eternal fairy stone that lets you go between a few key places on the map instantly. But to begin with, you had very few fast travel options. And so you were just constantly going across this, you know, very pretty, pretty is the wrong word. It's dreary, but like very melancholic late fantasy kind of world where everything feels like it's on the precipice of falling apart, and it is, right? You were playing the Arisen. You were playing this it's sort of like a Dark Souls-y type character in the sense of like, oh, you're undead. You're undead in this game. You died, a dragon kills you, and then you wake back up. But the rest of the world is not like that. The rest of the world is the kind of not Arthurian, but like fantasy knightly, you know, culture that is just about to fall apart because of corruption and cults and political intrigue. And the writing is not great, but it is evocative of all of these emotions that I'm talking about, all of these kind of feelings of decay. The action is really, really fun. It's probably actually closest to Streets of Rage 2 in some sense,
okay.
In that it's really great to string combos together. There are lots of classes that have very unique feeling combos. The magic archer feels like something kind of like Panzer Dragoon, where you're painting targets with this magical bow and then letting go and seeing like 8 different magical bolts of energy fly out. Whereas the strider is like a quick ranged character who runs up and attacks with daggers, or like the heavy knight has like a magical shield that they can summon cool little like sigils that can protect an AoE around them, or the like actual wizard and sorcerer classes can straight up just like, oh yeah, meteors are falling from the skies, you know? And all of that stuff feels so. It's the team that makes Monster Hunter. It's the Monster Hunter team. I think that there is some. It's a Capcom game. And I think that there is some Devil May Cry in there also. And so everything is really snappy feeling, but it's set in this world that is anything but that. Right? Like Monster Hunter is meant to feel like rambunctious and exuberant, and Devil May Cry is meant to feel badass and like kind of like scary but like punk rock demons, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
even
cool
old
demons.
Even old Devil May Cry is right, is like Dante's wearing a red leather jacket and eating pizza. This takes itself very seriously in a way that to me is like really charming and endearing, because I don't know that it has, you know, it's Capcom trying to make an action oriented Skyrim, and they're not doing that. Like, you're not going to read the books in this game, really. But there was just enough there with the lore and the setting to pull you in. And, like, it felt like a reset for me on fantasy, in that there's a moment when a griffin shows up out of nowhere and just eats a big cow and just, like, takes off with a cow. And the city guard is like, yo, there's a griffin. And you feel like that because so far you fought a cyclops, you fought a bunch of bandits and goblins and stuff. When the griffin shows up, and it's like a real object, it's not a cutscene. The griffin shows up,
yeah.
And then they were fighting a griffin for a few minutes as it's trying to steal this caravan away. Everything has this deep physicality to it. It's a game sort of like Shadow of the Colossus, where you're climbing on things a lot, and it's a really fascinating blend of all the stuff that is packaged in. And this is where the fast travel stuff comes in. A really difficult game when it comes to resource management. It's a game where the night is pitch black, like it's actually dark. It's hard to see where you're going, and so many of the game's missions are about leaving your hub and going off into the night. And it replicated this amazing feel for me of what playing kind of a certain brand of tabletop role-playing game feels like. Not the sort that I tend to play these days, which is very narrative-focused and very focused on, like, rolling cinematic action, and instead the kind that is about, like, hey, did you pack enough rations? Hey, like, are you really ready for this trip?
Nitty-gritty stuff.
Yeah. But also, I mean, that has its roots in a sort of fantasy literature also, yeah. right? Like, there is like, did we pack enough of the oven Lembas bread,
yeah.
To make this trip? And that is exactly the game, Rob. Like, it is, did I pack enough greenwares? Can I, which is like an herb that you can splice into other herbs to create curatives? Did I bring enough anti-fire stuff? Like, okay, the quest says I'm going to this castle. What do I know about what's between here and there? All right, I remember I can cut through this secret tunnel, but I'm probably going to run into bandits and maybe a troll there, so I have to bring fire arrows because the troll is weak to the fire arrows. And you just the map like really unfolds itself to you, and you're doing a lot of quests in the same places, but it's that feeling of like playing an open world game like Saints Row or GTA, where like it becomes embedded in your mind that you know the dream of those games is like you get into the car chase, but you know the world better than the AI knows the world, so you know where the secret is or the secret shortcut is or whatever. That's this, except it's about journeys. It's about like, it's like, if what if you were playing Darkest Dungeon and then you like you opened up the map and it was like, oh, actually, because you've run enough things in the ruins, you know a secret route from this room to this other room way across the map. And it just feels cool to learn that entire thing. There's a lot there. There's a lot more that I could talk about around like your little AI buddy. You can recruit AI buddies from your friends and they learn the world as they go off and go on journeys. And so they'll come back and say stuff like, you know, if they fought an enemy that you've never fought before, because one of your friends borrowed them to go fight and do that quest, they could be like, oh, hey, it's weak to ice. Like, hey, Arisen, it's weak to ice. And like, oh, okay, cool. I'll use my ice attack. They don't know when to shut up. It's really annoying if you're the sort of person who hates repetition and vocal, like, the same voice clips over and over and over again. But it just works for me. Like, it's just like, for whatever reason, it just completely transports me to that space in a way that, like, for me, Breath of the Wild is the sequel to Dragon's Dogma I didn't get.
Yeah.
A lot of the same stuff happened there. And it's part of why I was surprised that people loved Breath of the Wild was like, y'all, you should go play Dragon's Dogma. It's like this, but like rougher and with some more interesting ideas. I could go on about Dragon's Dogma all day, which is why it's probably realistically in my top five.
Yeah.
I guess the other big outlier here is King of Dragon Pass. It is the only like...
That one, I don't know what it is.
Boy, we should play King of Dragon Pass. Rob, have you played that?
No.
Oh my God.
I mean, it comes up a lot. It's come up a lot on Through His Head.
We should play King of Dragon Pass.
That should be a stream one day.
We don't have the time right now because it's not a sit
I'm
down and play
today.
Once.
One
no,
day.
But I mean, it could be a stream when we're done with XCOM Battletech Stellaris.
Like,
you know what I mean?
Okay, it's one of those.
So it's from the late 90s, 1999. It's set in the Glorantha universe, which is a tabletop role-playing game universe.
Duck monks?
The duck monks are from King of Dragon Pass,
duck
yes. So you play a ring of Norse-adjacent, like, people... You're basically are running a town. You're running a town. You've escaped from the evil pharaohs. You've gone north and are settling in this fantasy. It's a fantasy world. Like HeroQuest, RuneQuest are set in the same fantasy world. And you have a council of people who all represent or who are all from a different kind of religious background. They each have a different kind of god or goddess that they worship. And it is your job to like make sure you have enough cows and to make sure that the gods are pleased and to sometimes go on a hero quest where like everybody gets together and does a bunch of drugs, presumably, and then like slips into the realm of heroes and recreates the great myths of old. And it's like a point and click. It's like a visual novel meets a city builder. Like, you're building out your town. You're deciding whether or not to invest in better, like, fences and how much land to convert from trees, from forests into farmland. But also there's politics because there are other tribes that you need to, like, keep your relationship with. And then there's, like, random events where, like, a big tree person will wander into town. Sorry, there's a weird noise over there.
A tree person wandered into town.
A tree person wandered into this room happened. Just now. it's so flavorful. If you are curious about it, two things. One, I did a stream of King of Dragon Pass, a Giant Bomb. I did one years ago at Stream Friends, too, but I don't know if that one's anywhere. But the Giant Bomb one should be up. And then I also, I don't know that I can recommend it fully because it's been too long. But like a decade ago, I read the Let's Play of King of Dragon Pass that's up on lparchive.org. So again, I can't vouch for the content. I don't know if there are like shitty jokes. I don't know if there are like, I don't know if I should put content warnings on it or not. But 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I read it and loved it. It's a super long Let's Play. It's a text-based Let's Play. And it is really, really fun to see like all it's a great intro to the world because the character – the kind of goal of the game is to unify all these disparate clans and become the queen or king of them and to kind of take over and create a new culture or a new like unified set, like place in that world, which is what happens in that fantasy world, right?
But without questioning the political order of the time, huh?
Well, no, because you are constantly doing that, right? Like you are – the entire thing is like, okay, who is in charge of your ring? Is your ring, you know, it's good. It's the gods' favor if someone from one of these three different godly orders or whatever religious orders is your clan leader or is your council leader. But you could put, you know, Humacht, the god of death, there instead, or instead of putting Orlanth there, who is the kind of father of the gods. You could have an entire, you know, clan council dedicated.
Does the game respond to stuff like that?
100%.
So we're worshiping death.
Because,
now.
Well, the thing is, the goal is actually to have somebody from every religious background on your council or a mix of them, because different things will come up that way, right? Which is like, oh, because we have someone from Errol or Elral, who's like not the horse god, but like the god of all horsemen and cavaliers.
Okay.
Like sometimes you'll be blessed.
Sounds
on,
like a horse god.
On, yeah, yeah, right? Be blessed on the battlefield. Yeah. Or if you know, there are times when, excuse me, someone will come through and be like, we're super sick. Oh, God. There's like an entire god that is like the bear god who is the bear god who likes to kill the undead. He has like bear brothers, ox brothers. I think they're bear brothers.
Are they bear oxes?
There might be bear oxes.
Okay.
They might be. I think they're all bears. If I remember definitely
Papa Bear.
No, you do not. Well, if you go on the right hero quest, you can meet Papa Bear.
Oh.
The Bear Brothers will come to town, and it's like it's custom to let them come and drink. Because what they do is they just go from place to place fucking up the undead.
Mm-hmm.
But are they really doing that, or are they just going from place to place getting drunk?
And telling stories,
right. And so you go to your council, and you mouse over each of the council members. And, you know, you're the guy who's like kind of associated with them by closeness, but he doesn't worship them. It's like, we honor our bear brothers. And then the you know, wise cow mother worshiper is like, you know, let them drink a little bit, but then tell them we ran out. So then they move on to another town.
Okay.
And the trickster god is like, oh, it's good to play tricks on people sometimes. So give them, you know, give them water and tell them it's
Moduls.
Right, give them Moduls, exactly, and tell them that it's all literally the type of thing. And so even your own council is constantly bickering over what to do. It's really fucking good. Like, look it up. It's called King of Dragon Pass. And I think that's probably maybe the outlier in the other way, which is like, that's the one for me that is, it's not going to be on anybody's list. It's a weird game that came out in 1999. It never comes up in conversation.
I assure you it would make a Three Moves Ahead top 10.
Someone would push it in.
Troy would
do it. You're right.
He might.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a sequel coming called Six Ages that I'm so excited for. It doesn't have a release date yet.
A 20-year sequel?
I mean, 1999, so 30-year sequel? No, 99 is, yeah.
It's almost 20.
20 years. 20 years next year.
Is this just like people inspired by it? Or like,
No. It's the same. There's 100% connectivity with the
working on it for 20 years.
Well, no, they have not been working on it for 20 years. They're just like, they left it.
Right.
And then they're coming back.
Event change. All right.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So again, that's King of Dragon Pass.
Wow.
I'm
ready to start fucking playing that right
now.
Dude, it's so good. You should at least look at some art and some videos of it. It's. You know what it is?
Once
like,
we wipe out the slave people, we should play this.
Totally, 100%. And also, here's the other thing.
Yeah.
Is if you left God of War being like, I wish they did more with mythology and just like obviously it's not Norse mythology. It's very clearly Norse inspired mythology. But like if you are the sort of person who plays those games and is like, oh, I really love myths and I really love the stories of gods. I really love how there are different interpretations of the stories of gods. Like one last thing on this game and then I'll stop.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Every once in a while, it's wise of you to do a hero quest, which is, again, you're reenacting one of the myths that you know as a people. You've had to spend time researching the myths and, like, trading with other cultures and learning the myths and, like, piecing them together. And eventually you kind of get a document that is like, here's the myth. Then you send someone, again, you all do a bunch of drugs because you're all like, you know, you're all out in the woods doing drugs. It's a festival. And you're like, we're going to push someone into the spirit realm. And again, the game never really... It might be the case that just everyone is high out their minds and are all LARPing. But you could also have pushed, you know, Janella into the spirit realm where she is going to reenact the great story of the cow mother going into the underworld and facing her terrible sisters and coming back up with whatever the thing is she retrieves from the underworld. Or Orlanth, you know, facing down the devil wind or whatever, right? And so they reenact it, and it's a kind of choose your own adventure, or it's not choose your own adventure. It's like a multi choice like thing where it's like you have to. The goal is to go through and say like, okay, at this part of the stage, what did the cow mother do? Oh, she let the wolves bite her until they had their fill, and then she continued on her journey. And then it's like you get a picture of the wolves attacking, and like, well, are wolves attacking your person or what? And like it rolls the dice based on their stats, and like, do they make it through or not? And one of the coolest things is, you know, if you replicate the myth as it is, you get something cool, and then you get to, like, you come back out, and everyone celebrates. Oh, the cow mother came back, and Janella is now, like, she walked the path of the cow mother, and now our soil is good for the next, you know, four, you know, seasons or whatever, right? Or you get down there, and you can be like, oh, I don't want the soil to be good. I want a dope sword. I want a clay pot that's always filled with wine. I'm going to change, or like you get to the wolves, you're like, no, I'm going to stomp on the wolves.
Huh.
And there's a chance that like, it's like, oh, well, that's not what happened. The hero quest fails. There's a chance if the magic is blowing the right way that day, if you know what I'm talking about, the magic is blowing the right way.
Yeah, when the magic's blowing, you're right. Yeah. Wow.
The myth just changes course and you rewrite the myth in a sense into your own clan's version of it. And it's like, wow, that's awesome. And is not in any other game about mythology. It understands that myths are living and are you know, even
constantly
inside of worlds
evolving,
where there are gods and goddesses and centaurs that you fight. Also, the elves fucking suck in that game, but I like it in games
good.
When elves suck. It's like a cool thing to be like, yo, those elves
they're the
worst.
Shitty elves.
Shitty. I love shitty elves so much. All right. So I'm done talking about King of Dragon Pass.
I love shitty elves.
On Steam is that's King of Dragon Pass.
That is King of Dragon Pass. Don't buy it yet, because let me make sure that it's like in a good state first. It's definitely on iPad, and that version is 100% good.
Okay.
It's a very good iPad game.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm very intrigued by all of this.
Me too, and I know this game, so...
So while Austin gets us a definitive answer on whether or not this version is good...
yes.
Danielle, what's your top 30?
Yeah, it's around that. Let's see. There's a pretty obvious through line to most of my games on here. I'm just going to go through the sort of top 10 that has some asterisks, and then I'll give you my honorable mentions very quickly. Are we ready? This
yes.
is generally in order from 1 to 10, but
okay.
it's not a hard order, but it's a general order. Ahem. Psychonauts.
Mm-hmm.
Bioshock.
Mm-hmm.
Prey. Donkey Kong Country, in parentheses, maybe all of them. But if you really want the order... It's probably
what's the one you would pick?
2, 3 Tropical Freeze, 1 Returns, Banjo-Kazooie,
okay,
Gone Home, Anodyne, Majora's Mask / Wind Waker,
Those are two different games.
No, it's one.
They're like wildly different.
Mass Effect 2 and Super Mario 64. And then here are the close contenders for today. Fez, Mario Kart 64, Into the Breach, Breath of the Wild, Soma, Crazy Taxi 1 and 2, Diddy Kong Racing, and Brutal Legend. We can focus only on the top 10, and we can talk about the other things later. So
Tropical Freeze is definitively not the best one.
I think it might be the best designed one. I think it might be, if you're talking about like the craft versus my personal favorite, it might
not
be.
We're talking about appreciation. We're talking about love.
Yeah, we're talking about love, which is why it's very difficult to unpack the order for me of the Donkey Kong Country games. Because I loved them so much and they were so formative. But I recognize that Tropical Freeze is the best designed game. I think it is phenomenal and it is definitely up there on my top 10 list. But I have a very hard time. This is why I put Donkey Kong Country, maybe all of them, as my number four list pick.
But it probably does come down between one and Tropical Freeze for you.
Two or three.
Two or three were the top one. Three, yeah. Right?
Okay, two, three.
I thought three was not well regarded.
No, Patrick thinks it sucks, but I love three. It has all these adventure elements. It's really, really fun. It has maybe the wildest art out of all three of those games. So I love three. Patrick doesn't like three. He's the one who doesn't like three.
Okay.
For the record, you know, I love three.
So what do you think the outlier is in that set?
I actually think the outlier is Mass Effect 2 because of the way you move in that game. Now, also, ooh. Note, Gone Home is also on here, and that's like a slower-paced game, a more story-based game. Yeah. I feel actually like they're – why I love Mass Effect 2 as much as I do and Gone Home are of a piece for ooh. Sure. And it's just gay, 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 gay. I played Mass Effect 2 as like – this was the very first game.
Right.
I ever played where I could play as a queer space lady.
Who did you romance?
See, that's the thing. I'll tell a very quick story. I'll make it very brief. I played Mass Effect 2 in 2010, right when it came out. I had never played the first one. I fell so hard in love with this game. I played it for like 55 hours. I did every little thing. I went on the not even really a date with your like ship assistant lady, but I was just so excited that I could go on a date with a lady that I was like over the moon for this game. I went back immediately. Played through one, Romance Liara, and then immediately after that, played two again. So I played 2-1-2 in rapid succession, never taking a break for like a day, for months out of 2010.
Right.
Because of how much I loved the fact that I could play as a cool space lesbian. And then, of course, I continued my romance with Liara and Shadow Broker, the Mass Effect 2 DLC.
Okay, that makes sense.
So
okay.
I like, it's slightly complicated. The answer is Liara. It was also, what's his face, the really hot, Jacob. I romanced place. Him the Jacob first time place. Around because I didn't have any real lady options right, the first time when that actual, game first launched.
That's the thing is, like, there are women in that game who, in my memory, like, it's
Jack
wild to me that Jack
queer.
Is not.
She's bi, but, like,
you can't
romance her as a woman.
Right,
exactly.
As a woman, yeah, exactly.
Sucks. It's such bullshit. So, like, that's the one also for me that I look back on. I'm like, missed opportunity, missed opportunity, missed opportunity. But I loved it so much at the time that it still deserves a place on this list.
When you can date Liara by the time – oh, yeah, you didn't play one previously.
Right.
Gotcha. Right. One almost makes my list.
Yeah, I think one is probably the best game in that series when you're looking back. Obviously, it's a little it's a little broken. It's a little janky.
It would fit my list of
– It would fit your list for sure.
Broken fucking game.
The last act of that game, though, makes up for a lot.
Oh, it's so good.
It's not even just that last – it is the last act. Last act is incredible.
Yeah.
But I count everything from Vermeier through to the Daniel Wall.
Okay.
Like, basically, like
– Yes. Vermeier forward is just A-plus all the way.
Oh, it's so good.
Fucking meeting Sovereign for the first time is so good. That whole game is just
coming to the tomb of the Protheans.
Yeah,
yep.
And they all thought they were going to ride this out.
They did. That's all they thought it was going to be. No big deal.
They left, they left a little bit for us.
Yeah,
I guess.
Did you ever finish the series, Daniel?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I did.
Did you play?
And I liked three.
I
liked three.
I liked three.
You didn't, Rob.
You should finish that series at some point.
I mean, I never played Andromeda, if that's what you mean. But, I played the first three games. Yeah.
I really wish I'd liked Andromeda, even if I liked it. Even if I liked it and it was bad. Do you know what I mean?
I kind of still feel tempted to play that
game. You should play it.
I honestly feel tempted sometimes to play it.
I've been intrigued. Like, Rich Stanton has been pretty... Like, he feels the game got a bit of a raw deal. Like, it's underrated as a Mass Effect narrative. I've seen that in a few other places. Like, that...
I don't agree.
It sounds like there's just too much bullshit stuffed in.
So much bullshit stuffed in. It has some cool ideas.
Yeah.
But they are between. Like, I think that there are a handful of main story missions that have cool ideas specifically. But the structure of the game and the pacing and the lack of characterization around certain characters is such a bummer. And just like, it never feels, it neither feels like a Frontier nor like an inhabited world. And I think the biggest mistake was just, they had the opportunity to remake Mass Effect 1 in a sense. They went to a new galaxy and
in the Wild West
to have it be like, wow, we're not even just like in terms of the actual moment to moment experience of playing the game. Mass Effect 1 is a game where you are uncovering new stuff for you, the player, constantly.
Yeah.
Who are the Hanar? Who are these weird jellyfish people? What's up with these, like, the Elcor? Like, what's up with, what's going on with this crime syndicate? Like, what's going on over here with the Reapers? What's going on with the, between the Geth and the Quarians? And that, like, represents a great deal of setting building work and, like, creating a new universe. And they had the opportunity to do that again with Andromeda. And instead, they introduced two new cultures and, like, neither of them is particularly interesting.
Yeah.
Or they're fine. They would be fine if they were two in a set of seven or two in a set of five. But they're, when they're only the two and one of them is just the bad guy faction, it's just rough. It's just, you don't get any of that scratch. You don't get to scratch any of that itch, rather, which is just such a fucking shame.
Yeah.
Because...
Did either of you ever play the Solus Project?
No.
No.
So that's a, like, first-person exploration adventure game. I need to go back to it because I think they fit. I played it in early access, and there were some rough edges, but like, you are marooned on a distant planet, and it feels bizarre and alien in a way very few space games actually do. It feels odd and spooky and haunted in some of the ways that like, some good sci-fi horror does. Right, there's a little bit of what it feels like outside the Nostromo in Alien. Or there's a little bit of 2001.
Right.
Where the sky is profoundly different and odd and strange, the movements of the planets. But then you're uncovering this evidence that, like, oh, there's an entire civilization here that went extinct. But in the meantime, you're also struggling with a lot of survival issues and trying to sort of link back up with your research team.
Right.
And I think that's kind of one, it's kind of a cool thing. It's worth looking at just for how well it evokes some of that vibe. But I think it's also getting at some of what I would want from, if your premise is we've journeyed beyond the farthest imagined frontiers to a place where everything is literally alien. Like, there's no connection back to Earth or what we've known before. That should feel scary.
Yeah.
And almost oppressive. And Solus Project does for a lot of it.
Right. I didn't play that game, but Vinny at Giant Bomb and I did a quick look of it where he played. And again, very much like you said, like, we played it when it was unfinished and a little rougher.
Yeah.
But there was something there, and there was a moment when we were like, for whatever reason, we like got way off the beaten path and like up in this very high plateau of these almost like basalt columns, like these very like geometric huge columns, octagonal. I always say octagonal because my brain works that way. Octagonal columns, and this storm rolled in that neither of us expected. That was the loudest thing. We were both scared. Like, we were both like shook by the intensity of the storm. And it was like definitely one of those moments like, oh, this game might have something on top of the interesting sci-fi like stuff that was going on. A game that might also be able to do some of that stuff, not the storm so much, but the like sci-fi alien mystery that's coming out soon is Outer Wilds, which I played at PAX and talked about at PAX. So just keep your eyes on Outer Wilds is what I'll say.
I want to try both of those.
Yeah.
For sure. If I look at my list, I definitely see a couple of through lines. One of them is moving beautifully through like gorgeous, beautiful places.
That's definitely the Donkey Kong Country. That's the
Banjo-Kazooie, Mario 64. Dishonored on
there? No,
Dishonored's
not
actually
on. Okay.
But Prey is.
But Prey is.
Prey sure is.
Yeah.
So is Bioshock.
Yeah,
but Prey
doesn't,
so
have that same like fun movement stuff, right?
Yes, it does.
I think it does.
Okay.
I think it does, personally. You're jumping around, especially if you got weird with the glue gun. And like started like dropping all over the place.
I was thinking of, sorry, I was not thinking of traversal. I was thinking of movement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
I was thinking
they're different
the,
types
like,
of movement.
Yeah,
you're totally right. They're different
types
of like an adjacent concept. Uh-huh. For sure, for sure. Sorry to say adjacent again. Majora's Mask and Wind Waker are just my two favorite Zelda games, and I think they're both gorgeous. And they say they are, one is like the depressing version and one is like the happy version, and they're both the weird Zelda,
right,
in a lot
right.
of ways. Until Breath of the Wild came in, and again, like Breath of the Wild's probably going to be on this
in list 3 years or something.
At some point, exactly. It'll just be this, this, this. It'll just be Majora's Mask / Wind Waker / Breath of the Wild, because right. I cheat and I don't care. The one that's probably not on most other people's list would be Anodyne, which is basically right. a truly great, my favorite 2D Zelda. I say that all the time, mm-hmm. But much weirder, much darker, much more like introspective. It was a tiny indie project. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful game that does a lot of things really super well. The only thing I'm sort of shocked at in terms of omission is that there's no like adventure games or puzzle games.
There's no adventure games. There's no puzzle games. I think puzzle games is a tough one because puzzle games are games that like devour your time,
yeah.
but are also
maybe Into the Breach.
If we for people like us who play a bunch of like narrative driven games
yeah.
where it's so easy to remember character,
yeah.
Or who are playing strategic games where it's so easy to remember anecdote. Puzzle games are like pure mechanics, and like there are definitely puzzle games that I've lost more hours to than some of the games on my list, but it's hard to recall them and recall the joy of them to be like, oh right, that has to be on this list because XYZ, it does, it should. It's almost unfair to them that they're not in some ways.
Yeah, that's a really good point, for sure.
But yeah, Into the Breach is
close. I almost
close.
Feel like Into the Breach might be in there, and that's, again, that's one that's probably going to be in this top 10 one day. It's in the honorable mentions right now, for sure. And Banjo-Kazooie and Mario 64 are so good. I have a weird, like, twinning in this, almost. Or, you know, Psychonauts pretty much sits at the top. Because that is sort of an adventure
that
game
has
in a lot of ways.
Gamey elements,
it's
right?
very adventure gamey. It's like 20% adventure game, 80% platformer. It's just colorful and funny and weird and just captures the things I love in a game, which is moving beautifully through weird and beautiful worlds and finding a lot of things to be excited about and think about when
right.
I'm not playing it, that
right.
kind of thing. So, yeah, I feel like all of our lists are very us. Like,
yeah, but that's fine.
I think it's a good thing. I'm saying, like, that's a positive thing. Like, I'm excited to hear about them.
It's one of those things that definitely speaks to some of my frustrations with, like, greatest of all time lists.
Oh, yeah.
In their homogeny and, like, the boiled downedness of them. Of, like, you know, between us, that game, like, TIE Fighter would make that list before King of Dragon Pass would. And that's, I like TIE Fighter a lot.
It stands off the edges, though.
Totally. It stands off the edges. Exactly.
Stuff.
Anodyne probably wouldn't make that list, which is a shame. But like, oh, only Danielle played that game.
Right.
So,
of course.
You know, that's a tough thing to deal with. Like, it's why those lists are really hard to make and why they're often very easy to make fun of. It's
sure.
just like, none of our personal lists will look like that. Or if they did, it would suggest something very, very, it would suggest something about the scope of our interest or the scope of our access or the scope of our, like, time spent outside of the realms of, like, a very specific space.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. That's why it's fun to talk about
Outliers. Other people's...
Sorry.
What do you hate about other people's lists, Rob?
When they're all a little bit to what's happened lately.
Mm.
Like, what is front of mind?
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, and I wasn't trying to do this, but the only game I think from the last 5 years on my top 10 is like Dishonored.
And even that was what, 2011?
I think it's more recent than that.
Ooh.
I think it's like within the last 5 years.
Maybe 2012, actually. I'm pretty sure it might be 2012.
Which was this?
Just the first Dishonored.
Oh, Dishonored, yeah. 2011 sounds right.
But 2012,
it was 2012,
it is 2012.
Because it was a year after Deus Ex.
So not even quite. Back. It's actually over 5 years.
Jeez.
Yeah, look at you. Yeah.
Yeah, but like, I think sometimes best of all time lists can end up being a little bit excessively like another example of the way we worship the new in this industry,
mm-hmm.
and the way we have this idea that, like, but, like, there is meaningful progress being made in this creative and expressive medium. And, like, to an extent that there's truth to the technical underpinnings of a lot of games, but I really don't buy, like, I get very skeptical when, like, a lot of the best of all time games appear to be fairly recent examples of like genre leaders.
So like that's so like seeing something like Mario Odyssey on a best of all time list would shake you.
It would make me.
It would shake me for a couple of reasons.
I don't think there's perspective on it yet.
Yeah.
Like I like, and that's that seems very presumptuous. It's like me saying like, Austin, I don't really think you know how you're going to feel about Breath of the Wild,
right.
In a couple years. Which, to an extent, duh. Like,
of course,
obviously,
not.
You don't know how you're going to feel about that.
Right, because the thing there is like, yeah, and that's why it's a provisional list representing my feelings today.
Yes.
Right. And not an end, not a like it will always be deferred. We'll always come back around. We'll always come back and evaluate it. Except here's the thing: I think that there. I mean, here's a counter argument for a personal list not relying too much on the old, which is two things. One, I think that there is often a bias to the old without reevaluation, right? I say TIE Fighter is on my list. I haven't fucking played TIE Fighter in a decade. I loved it. I remember loving it. I've not my critical tool set is so much more developed than the last time I played TIE Fighter. And so while I remember great things about the Thrawn storyline, while I remember great things about the power management and the mission design, I haven't reevaluated those things, let alone reevaluated them in a broader context of space sims, in a broader context both then and now of what kind of arcadey simulation looks like. There's all sorts of ways in which that the old it has like champion's advantage, has a higher seating because you just say like, oh, well, like Mario 64 invented the 3D camera. So blah, blah, blah. So it makes the list, right? And I'm not.
You can't compare LeBron to Jordan.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. yeah.
There
Jordan
go.
Played in the time of legends.
Exactly. That's exactly it, right? And so that's one. But two, there is something valuable on rushing to put something on one of these lists. Maybe not at the very top, but to say, God damn it, I fucking love Breath of the Wild. Let me enshrine it so that later, when I revisit this, it, one, will have already been rewarded once for the way it made me feel, but two, gains a little bit of that champion's advantage. And, you know, maybe be careful about where you hand that out. But like Danielle putting Anodyne on that list means that 3 years from now, she can look back and say, 3 years ago, I said one of my favorite games of all time was Anodyne. And that like puts a little chisel mark next to it that lets it hang on a little tighter in that list in the future. And ideally introduces it to some people who wouldn't otherwise see it.
Yeah.
So
well, I was thinking about a lot of this when I, you know, on this list right here, as of today, Prey is number three.
Right.
On this list.
Right.
That game is a year old. Like, it's only been out for a year, for sure. Like, I definitely kind of thought about that, like, all right, have I really, am I just doing the thing that I do? You know, is this a very like Danielle list in that way as well, where I'm doing the thing that I do, where I'm, like, championing so hard for this thing that I love? But I'm also really fine with that. I'm fine with my list saying these things and saying whatever values they say, right? Like, I'm okay with it being that as well, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think there's also something that's interesting, which is once you start looking at those lists, the thing that's on it becomes there is value in being like, here is a snapshot of how we felt about games in 2015, in which maybe Dark Souls makes that list. Sorry, Dark Souls didn't make my list today. If you'd gone back a few years and asked me if Dark Souls 2 or you know another Dark Souls game would have made that list, it might have. And then that list becomes a valuable document of a snapshot of where my personal list at least would be at. You know what I mean? Red Dead didn't make this list. 2 years ago, it might have in a weird way. 3 years ago, it might have. But the space for open world games has changed so much that it doesn't make the list today. And that's like, I don't know. I think as long as we're thinking about these lists that way, which I don't think dismisses what Rob is saying either.
Right. Not at all.
What is the sweet spot for you when you're like, all right, it's old enough, I can put it on a list now?
No, I think for me at least, it's more I've had like it just have I had time to meditate on an experience and have I revisited it since my initial playthrough?
Sure.
And like every game on this list like fits those criteria. I'm not sure. Like, a few years ago, I don't think TIE Fighter would have made the list, except I replayed TIE Fighter a couple of years ago.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I was, like, really stunned by how much better it was than I remembered. Like, what I had forgotten is the precision and responsiveness of that game and the way, how good it felt to fly in that game.
Right.
Like, in my head, I didn't remember that. And so when I went back and I revisited the game a couple years ago, I was like, oh shit, no, like the TIE Fighter that exists is actually a way more impressive game than the one that existed in my memory. So yeah, for me, it's just that it's that time and distance where you get to sort of, you know, you're not in the heat of the moment anymore. You're sort of now just coming at it a little more contemplatively and sort of fitting it into, I think this is a really good exercise, right? Like when you're putting the thing in the entire context of all the games you love, mm-hmm. and what you appreciate them, and now sort of juxtaposing, you know, this new contender with some of his old favorites. I think it's a really instructive process.
It makes me wish our jobs looked different. I mean, I'm sure that's every critic from every medium. Not true. It's so much easier to listen to music.
I was going
to
say music would be the outlier.
It's so much easier to watch, to even watch film in terms of time spent.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how long would it take me to get through enough of TIE Fighter where I felt comfortable reevaluating it and also its peers of its time versus doing the same, especially like ones I hadn't played, right? Free Space 2 is a game I'd never played and wish I had. And like, how long would it take me to do that versus how long would it take me to reevaluate the kind of space opera science fiction of the 70s? Mm-hmm. You know, still a sizable project, 100%. 100% still a sizable, important project. But
any single film is only going to be up to 3 hours.
Right, exactly. And so think about what else I can do with that time. Yeah. Even if I'm putting 1,000 hours into both projects, 500 hours into both projects, think about what I could do with that extra time when it comes to those films. I could do rewatches. I could be, you know, investigating the production process. I could be looking at its influences in literature, in music, in stage plays, in everything else, in comics. It's just one of those things that can be frustrating about working with games.
Well, and like, if you were to go back and like, I'm going to critically assess, like, I'm going to look, like, how do I really feel about Mass Effect 1?
Right.
To actually figure that out, you have to play the entire game.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't go and revisit, like, because those first 8, 10 hours of Mass Effect 1, you're going to be like, oof, this is pretty rough.
Kinda
I don't
broken.
Know. It's kind of narratively clunky. Mm-hmm. You don't really know until you finish that game, because that's where its best, like, parts lie. Uh-huh. Free Space 2 is a similar thing. Like, Free Space 2 is a great space shooter.
Right.
But again, it's that last act after God knows how many hours where it becomes a masterpiece. But, like, that's not an easy thing to go, like, oh, you gotta go and revisit the end of Free Space 2. Okay, 12 hours later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Speaking of, in the background, I've been looking up stuff on King of Dragon Pass, and there are two versions, and this, like, speaks to your exact thing.
Yep.
Rob, which is there's the GOG version, there's the GOG version, and then there's the Steam version. And the Steam version is the same one that's on iPad and Android, I think. Okay. Steam version is high res, and it has like 48 new events and new illustrations and a new lore map and new advisors and more interesting magical treasures and, you know, some other stuff like that. The economic system is different. There's like, it's a little less harsh when it comes to like keeping track of your cows and your sheep and stuff. But like, that's the thing, right? Is like, it's a different economic simulation. There are things you can't even fuck with at all anymore. You can't even look at the borders of what your clan's physical like map location are anymore. It has like a dot on the map that says you're here, but you don't get the original game kind of really drew out. Here is the borders of your Tula, which is like your kind of town, your township, basically. You know, in the original game, you could choose how many craftspeople you had versus how many farmers versus how many hunters. And so
it's a huge distinction.
It's a huge distinction. You can't decide how many craftspeople to have. You know, you could play as like a trading clan in the original game, where you didn't have that many people, you know, farming, but you had a lot of trades, a lot of craftspeople who could make stuff to then trade and make money and then buy the stuff you needed. It's way harder to do that now. And so it's like, well, which is, and there are other events that are missing and some that are added. And the GOG version is like super low res and the audio is not fucked, but the audio is not good. It's not quite there.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it is one of those things where it's like, the original developers were involved in this remake on Steam. I think you should probably buy that version. It's fine. It'll give you the experience I'm talking about. But like, which is the version that I would evaluate for my list? right? Especially taking into account my first experience with the game before I ever played it was just reading someone else play it for, you know, 30 hours or whatever. And so, like, I – even by the time I played my first couple of playthroughs of it, had already had a sort of systems understanding in place. This, games are such a weird, unique thing in that way. That is, or like, think about something like Bloodborne or Dark Souls. Think about something like Demon Souls now, where like the there's an entire system in that game that doesn't exist anymore because the servers are offline. That just like that part's gone, and that probably wasn't going to make or break my joy of my enjoyment of Demon Souls, but that thing is gone now, and that's like a it's a tough thing.
It's pretty major.
Or something like the Matrix Online, yeah. And something especially online oh, yeah. only games, especially so.
And even thinking about, briefly, something like the Majora's Mask remake on 3DS
right.
is definitely a much more sort of playable version.
Right.
It's prettier. It has a whole
Wind
sort
Waker
of,
on Switch,
Wind
too,
Waker
right?
Wind Waker as well on Switch. Yeah, I mean, like, they definitely made sort of minor changes in terms of, like, a later quest and everything like that. Like, that little bit of trimming, mm-hmm. literally trimming the sails. See, I knew there was a
nice
dad
work.
Joke
you did
there.
It.
Thank you. really helps. It really does make it sort of a more accessible experience.
Well, you can just... You also can change the wind way earlier.
That's
right?
the thing. Like, you
right?
get the swift sail, and you can actually just go fast whatever direction you want to go
right,
in. It's
right.
just so much easier and faster. But what's the canonical version of
right.
that game, right? It's very... And, of course, speedrunners all have their own opinions.
Of course.
Because of what glitch in what version of something.
Sure.
Which is interesting as well. But anyway, I guess that's probably a topic for another day.
For another day, yeah.
I am so glad we talked about our favorites today.
It was
felt
good.
Like a nice... I
hashtag
enjoy doing
faves,
this.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing this sometimes. We have some questions, but I think we should probably move on
since
we need to stream
still today. And
we
got some other work to do.
We got a big
also.
Boy.
We got a
you
big
know,
boy.
I
got to
edit this podcast. We got a big boy.
That's
we got to do all sorts of stuff. So I'm gonna close it down there. Thank you, Austin and Rob, for sharing.
Of
it was
course.
Like that. If you have questions, you can send them to questions. gaming@vice.com with the subject questions. As always, shout outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Thank you to Natalie for producing. She's on the wheels of steel today. That's that old phrase that people used to use in the old podcast and days. We're on Twitter at Waypoint.
You got Skip in the house? What?
I know, right? It's, you know, we're being nostalgic. We're talking about a lot of our old favorites, so, you know. Of course, we're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And you can read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Rob, where can people find you on the internet?
At Rob Zachman on Twitter.
Amazing. Austin, where can people find you?
At Austin_Walker.
You can find me, if you want, at Danielle R.I. Thank you so much for being here and listening to our show. This was episode 155 of Waypoint Radio, and I would like to tell you to be good and be good at it.
Bear Brothers.
Peace.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.